The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, I'm here with online news editor David Grimm, who's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site, news.sciencemag.org. So in our first story today, let's talk about personal genomes. Say I want to get my personal genome sequenced. Presumably, I should know all of the ailments that I'm at risk for, right?
Right. Well, you know, this is supposed to be the promise of the human genome and genome sequencing that, you know, someday soon we'll literally carry our entire genome around on a thumb drive and we go to the doctor and the doctor can diagnose all the various diseases that we're at risk for and prescribe whatever appropriate medications or exercise regimen or whatever to prevent us from developing everything from, you know, diabetes to cancer. Well, this new study kind of throws a bit of cold water on that idea. It sort of suggests that these efforts to sort of get everybody's personal genome sequence may not pay off as much as we think it will.
So how did they even begin to tackle that question?
Well, you know, they looked at something called genome-wide association studies, and these are studies that basically scan genomes and they look for hundreds of genetic markers. And these are really small, tiny markers. And the idea is that each genetic marker itself has a very low contribution to a disease. So if you say you have one genetic marker for cancer, doesn't mean you're going to get cancer. But if perhaps you have 100 genetic markers for breast cancer, maybe you're more likely to get breast cancer. At least that was sort of the going hypothesis. And the idea would be if we had, you know, everybody's genome, you know, doctors could just sort of add up all of these markers and determine, you know, your risk for various diseases. Well, the researchers in this study, they looked at a bunch of twins and they came up with something they call their genome type, which is basically this adding up of all of these risk factors for specific diseases to determine somebody's total genetic risk. And what they found is that even in the best case scenario, most people will have a genome type that gives them an elevated risk of developing just one disease. Meanwhile, they're going to test negative for up to 23 other diseases, even if they actually have an elevated risk of developing those diseases. And so what this indicates is that if we just rely on these genome scans, they're really going to be missing a lot of stuff. And so the question is really, how valuable are they going to be then if you go to your doctor and your doctor says, well, you're not at risk for X, Y, and Z, and it turns out you really are.
So positive markers may not actually result in developing the disease, whereas a lack of a marker, you may still get it.
Exactly. You know, the bottom line is really that you're not going to be able to sort of predict your medical future just by looking at these kinds of scans or just by carrying your genome around with you on a, you know, a computer or a chip or something like that.
Well, there are still some benefits to our personal genomic sequencing, right? Genomic medicine.
Exactly. And you know, a lot of people are at risk for very rare diseases, less common diseases that actually do have a very large genetic component. So it's possible that these types of scans could be really useful for those diseases. So, you know, this approach still has merit. The issue is it may just not be sort of as revolutionary as we thought it was going to be.
All right. And our second story today is about the conversations that we've all had with ourselves at one point or another to join Facebook or to not join Facebook.
Right, exactly. And, you know, what researchers sort of thought is, you know, you get that email in your inbox saying, hey, Jane Smith has joined Facebook. She wants you to join Facebook as well. And your decision, at least scientists thought, was really largely influenced by how many of your friends were on Facebook. So if you've got no friends on Facebook or just a handful of friends on Facebook, the idea was, well, you're not likely to join. But in this new study, researchers are actually finding that it's not really the number of your friends that are on Facebook. It's really the type of friends that you have on Facebook that will determine whether or not you join this very popular social network.
So when I think of Facebook, I don't necessarily think of detailed scientific study,
right,
and even detailed scientific methods. So how did they figure that out?
Well, they actually brought science to Facebook. What the researchers did was they looked at 54 million Facebook invitation emails. And these emails actually have a lot of information. Not only do they have information about the person that's being sent the email, but they have information about all the other people that are ostensibly these people's friends. They're also on Facebook, what their demographics are, you know, what their interests are and things like that. So what the researchers basically found is, say you get an invite to join Facebook and that person that's inviting you to join is a high school friend and you look at your email, it turns out everybody else that the email says you know on Facebook is also high school friends, that is really not going to be a big motivator for you to join Facebook. Versus if you got an email that said, well, you know, Jane Smith has invited you to join Facebook and she's a high school friend, but John Johnson is also on Facebook and he's a friend of yours that you know from chess club, and Tammy Smith is also on Facebook and you know her from the tennis group that you hang out in. That makes you much more likely to join Facebook, because rather than having, you know, 100 friends on Facebook from high school, it's actually more powerful just to have a handful of friends from a large number of different groups.
I feel like I know more about your hobbies now.
Exactly. I just made those up. Those are just, you know, hypotheticals. And the reason that researchers sort of think this is the case is, say you only want to join Facebook because you want to talk to people in your tennis group. Well, if you get an email that says, hey, a bunch of your high school friends are on Facebook, that's not going to be that interesting to you. So the more groups that are represented, statistically, the more likely you are to go, well, I wouldn't join Facebook if it was just my high school friends, but I will join because, you know, my tennis buddies are on there. The other idea is that it may be just be because there's sort of a peer pressure thing going on. Maybe the number of friends isn't that important, but if you go, wow, all these different groups that are involved and, you know, I've got friends that are on Facebook, that's actually much more powerful than just having a very large number of people from one group.
So what do researchers plan to do with this information?
Well, what's really interesting about this is it sort of contradicts what researchers thought about other social trends. You know, researchers thought, you know, we'll buy a brand of cereal or attend a concert or even pick up a new hobby because of the number of friends that are involved in either those hobbies or that buy that kind of cereal or whatever. And what this indicates is that the actual types of friends and the groups of friends could be just as important in influencing a lot of the social decisions that we make.
Right. And now for our last story, a super-powered flashlight.
Right. This is a flashlight so powerful that it can actually heal wounds and kill bacteria. It sounds like something out of Star Trek, I know. But the basis here is something called plasma. And plasma is basically sort of a gas, free electrons and ions that are produced in electrical discharges. If you've ever seen those sort of round plasma lamps, you know, in the mall, or I actually have one on my desk, it sort of looks like a fortune teller globe and you touch it and, you know, there's those streams that come out from inside and they change colors and it's all kind of neat. That's basically, you're looking at plasma. And researchers have already shown that plasma can actually kill bacteria and other bugs. And the reason it seems to do this is it generates what's called reactive oxygen species. And these highly reactive molecules can actually damage DNA. So if you expose, say, bacteria to plasma, then you essentially will kill the bacteria if they're exposed for long enough. And researchers have already tried to use plasma to kill bacteria and other microbes. The problem is the devices they've used are really bulky. They need this external gas supply. They need this external electrical supply because so much power is required for the electrical discharge that's needed to create the plasma that, you know, might be useful in a hospital setting, but it's not the kind of thing you could say take out to a war zone or to a third world country where, you know, doctors are traveling in the bush or whatever, and they need, you know, this nice portable device. So what this new research is all about is actually developing a prototype that actually looks a lot like a flashlight, to get back to your original question, but instead of discharging light, it actually discharges plasma.
Okay, so we have all these problems with scaling it down to a portable device. How are researchers attempting to overcome those difficulties?
Well, what this prototype has, the battery it has is actually too small to create plasma on its own. So the researchers use something called a DC booster, which actually steps up the voltage to about 10 kilovolts. And one output of this booster is actually wired to the device's shell, or it's grounded, as engineers say, while the other goes to an array of stainless steel needles, which create this rapidly pulsing electrical discharge. And the bottom line is that you're actually able to produce plasma with this portable device. And the research actually tested this out, not on actual people, but they grew these very thick films of this bacteria that's known to infect root canals in the mouth. And they found that when they exposed these bacteria to this plasma flashlight, as they call it, for 5 minutes at a distance of just 5 millimeters, a lot of these bacteria died. Even bacteria that were buried about 17 cells deep in these biofilms died. So it suggests that this not only is portable, but it actually could be effective in destroying microbes.
So how far along are these? Can I buy one at Target or CVS?
You're not going to be able to go out into the and buy one of these in a store just yet, Carrie. It still needs a lot of testing. And again, these researchers have just tested this device on just bacteria, basically in the laboratory. You really need to test it on people to make sure that A, it works, and B, that there are no unpleasant side effects.
Indeed. Well, cool. What a neat invention. All right. So what else have we had on the site this week?
Well, Carrie, for Science Now, we've got a story about the largest feathered dinosaur that ever lived. It was actually a relative of Tyrannosaurus rex. Also a story about using nanoparticles in the body to target and destroy cancer. For Science Insider, our science policy blog, we've got a story about how cuts to science funding are impacting research in Europe. Also a story about how science is playing into U.S. President Barack Obama's re-election campaign. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about the science of the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty. How might science convince nations to sign on? And next week's Science Live is about the science of decision-making. Why do we make the decisions we do? How do group decisions work? And how might the science of decision-making play into elections in the U.S. and abroad? So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Great. Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Carrie.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out all of our news at news.sciencemag.org, including daily stories from Science Now and science policy from Science Insider. While you're there, be sure to check out Science Live, a live chat on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.